From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the coronavirus outbreak has shut down all of China's 70,000 movie theaters, and that's just the beginning of its impact on Hollywood. Then, Zoe's extraordinary playlist, actor Alex Newell first found his voice as a child singing in church, but after he came out, things changed.
In one breath, the pastor is preaching about love and acceptance and treating your neighbor right, and in the second breath is telling my mother that there was something wrong with me.
And Zoe co-star Mary Steenburgen shares her own extraordinary music story. That's today on The Frame. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The human toll of the coronavirus is no doubt the worst part of the outbreak. More than 81,000 cases have been confirmed worldwide, with more than 2,700 deaths that have resulted from the virus, mostly in China. The virus is also taking an economic toll, with global stock prices plummeting over the past week. Hollywood is starting to feel the impact as well. Brandon Katz is senior entertainment reporter for Observer. So, Brandon, I think it's almost impossible to underestimate the importance of China when it comes to Hollywood. It's the second biggest movie market in the world, $9.2 billion in ticket sales last year. And right now, it's closed, right? All 70,000 theaters are shuttered, not doing any business.
Yes, correct. And they have been closed since about the end of January, which has completely and utterly taken out the Chinese Lunar New Year movie corridor. And that was expected to be a massive ticket sales generator and a huge boon for Hollywood to start off 2020. So it's really getting off to the wrong foot in terms of box office positivity.
And I'm going to just throw out some numbers. Avengers Endgame did $627 million in ticket sales last year in China. Fast and Furious Hobbs and Shaw did $200 million in China, which is more than it grossed in the United States. And it feels like while every company has something at risk in China, the Walt Disney Company probably has the most to lose. Why is that?
Well, right now, Disney is believed to be losing up to $280 million combined per quarter with the closures of both its Shanghai and Hong Kong theme parks. Now, in addition to that, the expected Chinese release date of Mulan, which will probably do at least $100 million in the Middle Kingdom, is expected to be postponed due to coronavirus concerns. So what you're seeing is a multi-pronged squeeze on Disney's huge revenue streams overseas. Now, China, of course, is not the only international market in the world. There are other hugely profitable overseas regions in which studios really count on for ticket sales. But it, like you said, it is the second biggest, and before this was actually on pace to overtake the U.S. as the biggest box office region in the world. Now, obviously, that is out the window for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, and it's not just China and Latin America and Europe. I think people are going to start getting really nervous about being in group settings. They might be concerned, and maybe unnecessarily so, of going to a movie theater with a couple hundred other people. Is it possible that that could be an issue that's going to spread across the world in terms of people wanting to go into a public setting like a movie theater?
Obviously, the main concern is the safety and health of citizens across the world. But when we're talking about Hollywood specifically, the greatest fear, especially following the White House confidence-sinking press conference, is that domestic theater going will begin to be effective. Now, if coronavirus fears start influencing American viewing habits, 2020 is going to be a monumentally down year for the industry. And that's coming off 2019, which fell about 4% to about $11.5 billion from 2018's record-breaking total. Ticket sales have been declining relatively steadily since 2002. Box office numbers keep going up because of inflation, but to keep that status quo relatively okay and healthy, Hollywood needed a little bit of a bounce back year. And with this coronavirus starting to impact viewing habits, not only here, but across the world, we're really starting to see growing concerns from all of the major Hollywood studios, especially as shares continue to drop across the industry thanks to coronavirus concerns.
We're talking with Brandon Katz at Observer about the coronavirus's impact on show business. I also think there might be an argument that streaming services like Netflix and Disney Plus might actually benefit if people don't want to go out and stay at home because they think that's safer. It could increase the market share for streaming services.
Yeah, it could. You know, right now, one concern adding to that 200 million lost primarily in China in terms of ticket sales is that piracy is going to compound that total endlessly until this scare is over. But like you said, in the meantime, certain releases might be able to be funneled to streaming and direct-to-consumer platforms. But of all the streaming services out there, Netflix is the one with the biggest overseas footprint. None of the major streaming services have a foothold in China at the moment. So still, that region is going to be affected. But if any streaming service is going to benefit from a negative situation, it will be Netflix, with more than 100 million overseas subscribers and years-long unmatched investments in really key regions.
Back in Los Angeles, it isn't yet being felt, but I think it's going to be felt. We have some movies like the latest Mission Impossible film that was shooting in Italy being shut down. And we also have issues like the Disney Company, in addition to the theme parks and the movies that come out in China, it operates cruise lines, and I don't know anybody who is booking a cruise right now. So at what point are jobs going to be affected back in Los Angeles, do you think?
Well, you know, jobs throughout the industry are already being affected. In Florida and Walt Disney World, Disney's actually told a small handful of employees to stay home because they recently returned from a trip to Italy. You're seeing the day-to-day operations throughout LA and other major sectors really start to be impacted. Travel restriction on employees are being imposed. Conferences or summits are being canceled. In fact, moments before we just hopped on the phone together, Facebook canceled its F8 conference, which is a, you know, very notable annual event. So you are starting to see the impact in day-to-day operations, even more so than box office and cruises and theme parks. And it is having a ripple effect throughout the industry that's going to be felt for quite some time moving forward.
I think it's also notable that CinemaCon, which is the annual gathering of movie theater owners in Las Vegas in a couple of weeks, already has sent out an email essentially saying, if you don't think it's safe, don't come. We think it's going to be okay. But I suspect even a convention like that is going to have an impact. Brandon Katz is a senior entertainment reporter for Observer. Brandon, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Coming up on The Frame, actor and singer Alex Newell actually finished second in a contest for a cameo on the TV series Glee, but that show helped make him a star. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. In the NBC musical Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, the lead character, played by Jane Levy, hears people essentially singing their feelings. The first person that Zoe confides in is her neighbor, Mo, played by Alex Newell. Fans of Glee will recognize him as the character named Unique. Like Mo and Unique, Alex is gender fluid and a powerful soprano. Between his network TV shows, Newell was in the Broadway revival of Once on This Island, and he released an album. In the upcoming episode of Zoe, his character hides his gender identity when he's singing in a church choir. And it's something that borrows a bit from Newell's own life.
I grew up in church, and so I think singing often and a lot, I saw what the reaction was when I was singing, and that I started to realize that what I was doing affected other people in a positive way.
And what was that like in terms of what you were singing about? Because there are a lot of churches that have a mixed history of inclusion and marriage equality and how they look at people who don't fit in a certain stereotype. So what was that like for you going through that experience singing in this setting that wasn't always hospitable to people who are different?
Well, I didn't know. I mean, I started singing when I was 2, and up until when I knew I was different, maybe 13, 14, 15, 16, up until then, I thought that I was perfectly normal. My sexuality wasn't a problem at church until I came out when I was 18. So it was kind of fine up until then. And then I realized that something was an issue and there was a discontent there and a disconnect as well. And I was 18 and I was on Glee, so it really didn't matter because I moved across country anyways.
So what was the disconnect? Because you had grown up in the church. Was there a new pastor? Did something change?
I mean, no one ever got in the pulpit and spewed hate. The disconnect was really of how my faith that was taught to me was different than the reaction I was getting from the leader of the flock. So in one breath, the pastor is preaching about love and acceptance and treating your neighbor right. And in the second breath is telling my mother that there was something wrong with me.
Where's that pastor now?
I have no idea.
But not at the church?
No, he's not. He's since quit. And we have a pastor now there, Reverend Kirk Byron Jones. He is amazing. My mother still attends that church and I go when I'm home. But he has me plastered all over the church, and he wrote a beautiful Facebook post about me and gave me the most beautiful accepting speech in the pulpit one Sunday over the holidays. So it's nice to have that reassurance.
We're talking with actor and singer Alex Newell. You mentioned Glee. I want to ask you about the crazy way you got on that show and how you stayed on the show. I think it was some sort of competition. Is that right, for a spot on Glee?
It was. It was called The Glee Project. It was on Oxygen.
I'm a huge Glee fan. I feel like I have a good personality and a good talent that I can share with the world.
What do you think it was that really made you stand out?
I want to say it was my giant range and voice.
Years ago, when Glee was like the number one show on American television, they started a online submission for the next new character on Glee, and they got over 40,000 submissions on MySpace, and I was one of the top 100, maybe 200, and they turned the idea into a reality show, and they flew us all into Los Angeles, and we made cut after cut after cut, and then I got on the show.
And you got on the show, and then you ended up, I think,
losing.
I was going to say came in second. Okay, you say
lost. Ryan Murphy looked at me first and said that, Alex, you were not the winner of the Glee Project, so I came in last.
But that wasn't the end of the story, was it?
No, it's not. There was a consolation prize, as I call it, of two episodes on Glee and a song on the Christmas album that year. And those two episodes turned into me being a series regular and being there forever.
If I were a boy, even just for a day, I'd roll out of bed in the morning, throw on what I wanted, and go.
It's funny that you end up on Glee in this setting, and then you are back on TV in a show that in some ways I think has a little bit of Glee's DNA in it. So can you tell us a little bit about how Zoe came up?
I was sitting in my apartment right after we ended our run of Once This Island, and I get an email for an audition, and it's called Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. And I was like, oh, sounds great. I'll go in for it. And then maybe like 20 minutes later, the appointment gets canceled. And an hour later, I get a call from my agent and manager saying, hey, they want you to test for the role. And I was like, oh, okay. You fly out tomorrow. Oh, all right, I'm on my way. And so I flew out to LA and I met Austin and Richard, Austin, the creator, and Richard, the director of the pilot. And I sang for them. And I did the scenes for them, and then I booked it. It was kind of fast-paced. I found out while at a bar with my friends. Funny story, one of my friends had an appointment to go in for Mo, and I was with her. She had it for the next day as we were just out gabbing. And I stepped out and got the call from my agents. Robert Ulrich, the casting director, called me directly to say that he wanted to call me directly to tell me that I got the role because he was a casting director on Glee who told me that I got on the Glee Project. So it's full circle. But she canceled that appointment 10 minutes after I walked back in.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a little funny story.
Funny slash awkward. But you say that you were with a friend and she was up for the part as well. How was the part written and how did you make it your own? Did it specify gender? How was it written?
No, Mo was a 31-year-old bisexual black woman. And they couldn't find anyone that could bring that energy, that love for music and that boisterous attitude and just a love of life in a lot of people. And when I walked in, Austin kind of really wanted to change the role and have it form-fitting to me.
That's the creator, Austin Winsberg. You're also meeting with the director, Richard Shepard. When Austin says he wants to make this character fit you, how did you want the character to fit you?
I think in the best possible way and in an honest way. I don't think that I live in a facet where I hide anything, and I'm very open with who I am and what I want to offer to the world. I can be private sometimes, but even that comes out. But I wanted it to be a heartbeat, and I wanted Mo to be something that was real. And it's very easy for a character like Mo to turn into a magical Negro that is all-knowing and very kind of just a trope, and I really didn't want that. I wanted it to be very grounded and very real and honest. I feel like most characters just need to be honest, and some of the best work that comes off of actors are the ones that are being themselves, because it always comes from a place of honesty.
I want to play a little clip from the fourth episode from Zoe, and it's a big episode for your character.
Oh yes, I'm the great pretender.
Mo?
Yes, Angel?
You just sang to me, like in a heart song way. Not in like a condescending, I'm gonna teach you the power of music kind of way.
I didn't feel anything.
I'm telling you, it happened.
I want to ask you about this episode because in some ways it mirrors what you have gone through on your own life, and it's about acceptance and about finding yourself. Tell us how important this whole episode was to you personally.
I mean, since it is something that I've experienced myself, I think the bigger picture is knowing that, not understanding and accepting faith. And faith isn't just believing in God or a higher being. It's like taking the step out on faith on yourself and being okay with sharing who you are with everybody else. It's very hard. I feel like we hide away from a lot of things in life. We can have the best of friends and still not tell them the whole truth, and we hide from them. And you can't be truly accepted unless you give acceptance to others as well, and you having acceptance of yourself as well.
We have talked a lot on this show about representation, and I'm wondering, when you were growing up, were there people that you saw in film, TV, and theater that made you think that you could do what you're doing now?
I mean, for me growing up, I didn't have that many people that looked like me on anything, and I had to really dig and find people that looked like me. And I go to Billy Porter, and I go to Titus Burgess, and I go to those that sound just like me, male sopranos. And I go to looking at Aretha Franklin and seeing someone that's plus size being at the forefront. I go to, it was hard to like see myself. And I think inclusion is a good thing, and it needs to happen more often, and we need to see more people, because I had to grow up looking at these amazing people but never really feeling like anyone looked like me.
But now you are that person to the next generation.
Yeah, I think that I'm so happy if I can inspire one little chocolate drop that thinks that they see themselves in me. I'm happy.
Alex Newell is a singer and actor. You can see him on Zoe's Extraordinary playlist. And now we're going to hear him sing Boy, You Can Keep It. Alex, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Zoe's Extraordinary playlist airs Sunday nights on NBC. Coming up on The Frame, Zoe co-star Mary Steenburgen has a strange musical story of her own. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. You just heard my interview with Alex Newell, who co-stars on the new NBC series Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. On that show, Jane Levy plays a young woman who, after a medical procedure, can suddenly hear the inner thoughts of other people in the form of popular songs. Levy's mother on the show is played by Mary Steenburgen. A few years back, Steenburgen had a real-life episode that resulted in music taking over her brain, and it led the actress to launch a second career as a songwriter. Frame contributor Tim Grieving has our story.
Is easy. I mean, I just literally, this is what I do all day. I play weird French little cafe riffs.
Mary Steenburgen is playing the accordion for me at her home in the Pacific Palisades.
I'm just making something up badly.
If you know her from dramatic roles like Melvin and Howard or as Doc Brown's love interest in Back to the Future Part 3, the image of Mary Steenburgen playing the accordion and writing songs may surprise you. How this all came about certainly surprised her.
In April 2007, I had a surgery on my arm, and it wasn't a huge deal, but it did require that I went under general anesthetic. When I came out from under the surgery, my arm felt fine, but my brain felt strange. And the best way I can describe it is that the sound of my mind for my whole life was different, and it was replaced with this sort of overscored movie. It felt like people's conversations turned musical, people's questions to me, the answer was somehow musical, street signs. It was like a musical tornado. And it was fairly terrifying and definitely utterly absorbing. I remember just looking in the mirror and saying, you know, it's not going away. So you've got to figure this out because you've got four kids. They count on you. You have a husband, you have a career, and you can't go nuts. You know, you have to make sense of it. I didn't know what to do other than just start studying how people wrote songs.
That husband she mentioned is Ted Danson, you know, from Cheers and The Good Place.
We flew to Europe with friends to go on this 2-week kind of holiday. We were in Italy driving in a van to go to the hotel. And I knew she had written a song that night while I slept on the plane. But she said, hey, I wrote a song. Do you mind if I sing it to you? And, you know, everyone kind of either literally or metaphorically kind of rolled their eyes and went, yes, of course, of course. And out came this really remarkable song. By the end of the summer, she'd written, I don't know, 40, 50 songs. And it truly was like I was married to somebody else.
I broke up with a man in the moon last night. Had enough of his whimsical smile.
She sang the music that was swirling in her head into a tape recorder, then professional musicians translated those ideas into songs. Pretty soon she'd signed a publishing deal with Universal, went to Nashville, and started churning out dozens of songs with co-writers.
I actually think it was more physical than magical. I feel like I connected to a part of my mind that I just didn't have access to before.
Which brings us to Wild Rose, the movie starring Jessie Buckley as a troublemaking young mom from Glasgow, Scotland, who desperately wants to go to Nashville to become a country music star.
I'm trying to be a country singer.
Nobody wants to see a convicted criminal up there.
Johnny Cash is a convicted criminal, you ball bag.
The movie needed a song for the big finale after Buckley's character, Rose Lynn, gets to Nashville and realizes there's no place like home. Steenburgen saw the call for song submissions through Universal. Inspired, she wrote the song Glasgow with two Nashville singer-songwriters, Caitlin Smith and Kate York. She pulled her iPad out and played me the original demo. This is Caitlin Smith singing.
I've worn out the stones in front of your doorstep. Come in, go away. Come in, go away. Come in and go in.
She's so freaking talented that I was scared that I said, I hope your voice is not too good to be sending in because it's intimidating. No one sounds like this. But then we saw this rehearsal of Jessie and we were all blown away, just blown away.
Had to find my way, make my own mistakes, but you know that I had to go.
You write something in a room in Nashville, Tennessee, and it goes over to Scotland and this Irish girl is singing it, and somehow you're all totally connected to it. You all own it.
Ted Danson is kind of in awe of his wife.
The biggest lesson, I think, was her willingness to say yes. It would have been much more reasonable to say, well, I'm not going to start writing music at 50, whatever she was. That's silly. I'm not going to have a publishing deal with a major label that's ridiculous. I can't go step into these Nashville artists who have been doing this all their lives and expect to be accepted. Everything was unreasonable, and yet she said yes to life.
Among the things Mary Steenburgen said yes to recently, she's writing the songs for an animated film called The Underneath. She'd also like to learn how to play the guitar.
It's much more useful to play the guitar, but I'm not good at stringed instruments, at least not so far. That's going to require another surgery.
That was a joke, she let me know. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn. A quick reminder, our digital newsletter goes out every Thursday. It's chock full of entertainment news, and there are tips for things to do this weekend. If you aren't a subscriber, well, you should be. So sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.